succession number 21720, Reel 3.
George Grey, Reel 3. So you were flying quite regularly into Germany then, were you, with 21st Army Group?
Yes, we were, especially when they got into Germany itself. And we went up to, for instance, we'd be on the outskirts of Paris, and I landed on a strip, and the only people there were the Pioneer Corps officer and his men who'd been laying a strip there. And an old chap came over to me, tall Frenchman, very old man, and said, "Ah," he said, "it's interesting, aeroplanes." He said, "I remember in 1920 something or other when I was near Villers-Coublay and I saw that," he was reminiscing about flying around the French, you know, regions and this sort of thing. And on another instance in Germany, a woman came over, of course, quite old in those days, and she'd been flying out of Berlin, and the aircraft stopped. They landed in a field while they mended it and all this sort of thing, which is rather ancient, isn't it? And so we then moved on up through we were close to Amiens for a while, and in nothing particularly going on there except our regular flying. We used to fly, as well as people, we used to go up to army groups and take letters and briefs and things like that. So we used to land on their army corps. I'm not sure what they call these things, but they were people who flew the same aeroplane as we did, these light aeroplanes, with a bit of armour, and they used to spot for the artillery, and they'd sort of hurl themselves off and keep over there. And one would go into one of these strips, and there'd be howitzers firing over a long distance, making quite a noise. And we would go in and have I would go in because I'm on my own, go in and have a meal with the two army officers there running the battery. And we'd be sitting in this little half-broken farmhouse with everything rattling away while these guns are firing all night and day, I think. Quite interesting. We had sort of one orderly and a mess lunch out of tins and all this. Rather nice, really, in more ways than one. In fact, going back to the pioneer officer, there was just him and I on a table on the edge of this deserted airfield, and a chap waiting on us, you know, at the table giving us lunch, which was rather nice.
Did you go when the Rhine was crossed? You know,
yes, I didn't see much of that, but I was in the area, of course. We moved up to Brussels for quite a long time at the time of Arnhem, which was a bad time. We saw all that people flying into Arnhem. And while we were there, towards the end, one winter time, we were attacked by jets for the first. Nobody's ever seen jets. And I wasn't personally attacked, but they were flying around the airfield at Melsbrook in Brussels and trying to bomb and strafe it and so forth. And nobody could hit them because nobody had seen anything going so fast as the ME-262s, I think they were, and things like that. And it was at that stage they had the Battle of the Bulge. And the Germans broke through in the Ardennes, and it was at this stage there was a big flap going on in the 21st Army Group because the Americans were doing it so badly that Montgomery was put in charge of the sector for quite a while to sort things out. They were not doing very well there.
That you were saying you were there at the time of Arnhem. Did you see anything of the?
No, unfortunately, only the aircraft going over.
You saw that, did you?
But we Arnhem was, as a chap said, a bridge too far, and nobody really saw it except it over there.
Was it quite a sight, though, seeing the aircraft go?
Oh, hundreds of them, yes, it was an amazing sight. See all these aeroplanes massing along, you know. It was quite a sight, really. So we then moved up into Germany and stayed at odd places. We finished up at a place called Buckerberg.
Buckerberg,
which is not far from Hanover. And we were based there for quite a long time until finally I left the Air Force. But at that stage, we were then, we were flying in and out of Berlin, which, of course, was completely destroyed. There's nothing there at all. Well, a few things there.
Yes, what did it look like from the air? You know,
it sort of looked like the roads, the main streets looked like country roads because the bricks had fallen down and they meandered along, you know, and just looked like a country road. And everything, absolutely everything destroyed, and a population where everybody was drab and they were short of food, and very, very many soldiers back from the Eastern Front, minus limbs. We saw a lot of people minus limbs because of frostbite and all this sort of thing. And terrible tales of being in the East and all that stuff.
This would still be while the war was going on, would it be after?
Just, more or less, it had ended at this stage. We didn't see much of Germans, except for prisoners and so forth, being marched along, because we were behind the lines, and, you know, we didn't get only a mile off the front and things like this, so we didn't see any of that, unfortunately.
Yes. There's been a lot of criticism, hasn't there, post-war, about Bomber Harris, you know, and the
bombing. Yes, yes.
Did you, you know, I wonder how you respond to that, having been involved.
Yes, that's right. Although I wasn't in on the night bomber squadron, I think I think Truman sort of said something like this, that it's in hindsight that one makes this judgment. Truman said of the Marshall Plan, you know, nobody knew what was going to happen. In fact, the Marshall Plan saved Europe, but nobody knew at that stage. And it's the same thing with the bomber. They thought the bombers could completely destroy all the cities, and indeed they were, you know, retaliating for Coventry and so forth. But it was getting a bit long term. But the tactics of the bomber, the night bombers, was to find areas of the city, of German cities, which would burn, and then check wind directions, and then particularly bomb these to set the city on fire, because they knew that once they did this, you'd get what they call firestorms and all this sort of stuff. And it was a total war, and the Germans had waged it one way, and I think Churchill and Harris thought perfectly legitimate to wage it another way. And there was arguments about, for instance, Dresden, and people were saying, well, Dresden was not a legitimate target, but at the time, you know, it was rumoured there were plenty of soldiers and defences in Dresden, so it's a misfortune of the war, really.
You were saying earlier on, it was very interesting, that when you were doing your cloud, you know,
yes,
creating your cloud, you were also training for poison gas.
Yes, that was when we were using this aniseed spray. Yeah.
Was there serious thought of dropping?
I think they thought of everything, really, and that's why people had respirators, that if the Germans started using this thing, we'd have to. You know, it was a tit-for-tat sort of thing. I don't think they were too serious about it, but it was there in their minds.
Yes, and there would have been stocks of gas if necessary.
I presume there were. I'm sure there were. Mm. Yes. Mm. But that was as far as it goes. I only know that was one of the techniques that they, you know, were expected to use.
So, do you remember VE Day at all?
Yes, I do remember it vaguely. I wasn't in London at the time. I can't remember where I was, but the war had been winding down, and E-Day really didn't, you know, the Germans were beaten, and E-Day didn't really mean anything. And it became rather obscure as sliding into this Cold War. And eventually one came to spend a lot of time in Berlin, in certain sectors of Berlin, and see the population and realise that they were more of a provincial village town than a big city, and the surviving there must have been quite a business. I mean, there was one place we stayed in the Grunewald, and there was a milkman there with a horse, and I think he drove this horse and milk cart through all the war bombing and everything. Amazing.
What were your plans post-war? You know, having really, I suppose, your young life was spent in the air, wasn't it?
It was, really. And, of course, the whole point about then was the airline were recruiting, and most pilots the majority of pilots were saying, oh, I'm going to go back to the place where I live and carry out a job that I would like to do and be a civilian. And the idea of going on to at that time seconded onto an airline didn't appeal to a lot of people, and it was vastly different, because as soon as you become a civilian, you've got to find, everything's not found for you. You've got to find somewhere to eat and live and everything like this. And I think a lot of people coming out of the forces have found this, but being transferred to an airline was a similar environment, really. Very similar, but more relaxed.
Did you have any choice at all, you know, when at the end of the war?
Yes, to go into the airline, there were all sorts of jobs on offer. And there was another one of the generals I used to fly around called Wansborough Jones, and he ran on the transport system of the 21st Army Group. And he said, well, you know, I said I was going to the airline, and he more or less said, oh, well, I, you know, if there's anything you'd like me to recommend you for, would do it. And I said, well, I'm more or less happy with that. But there were lots of opportunities, I think, for that sort of thing. You know, for any sort of thing, I mean, not just that. I mean, for instance, when I was training with BOAC, I was in Bristol, and the only accommodation we get are these large boarding houses, and I used to share a room with two or three people, and one of them had been a Gurkha officer, and he was training to run a laundries, you know. There was all these sort of jobs which were going, of course, if you wanted to move into something new.
So how was it you went into BOAC after the war?
It was just I was flying then, flying in and out of Berlin to various places in Europe, and I just thought it would be natural to carry on doing it. And if you don't have a break, you can then just go and do some base training and pass the test for learning about the aeroplane, and then just move on to the airline. And I wasn't there very long as a co-pilot, and then I became, you know, very quickly became a captain. And that would be 46. And so there I stayed as one till 81, about 1981.
So, could you tell me something about the formation of BOAC? Who was it who had this idea of having a sort of nationalised airline?
I can't remember now. I really can't remember, because it was just said that it was the Conservatives, and I can't remember any particular figure that said it.
But it was a Conservative party?
Yes, that was a strange part. It was certainly under the aegis of the Conservatives, whether as a government or whatever, but they were determined to do it. And took over Imperial Airways and all that sort of thing, you know. BOAC was really Imperial Airways. And then there was the other outfit from Hendon. They were British, they were then called something like British Airways, weren't they? Short-haul route people.
Was it BEA? Before
BEA was formed, it was just called British Airways, and they flew Lockheed aircraft. They were the sort of people who brought Chamberlain back from Munich and things like that, and so forth.
So did you have to have retraining?
Only to convert onto the base training. Oh, and we also had to take a navigator's license as well, which is a bit tedious. I mean, you know, we went on doing all this navigation stuff for a month or two, and that was a little bit tedious. Had to pass all exams like swinging aircraft compasses and various things like that, which people don't do today, and they don't navigate anyway because they've got these inertial platforms on the airplanes that tell them where they are anyway, so they don't need navigators anymore.
And would you still have been in the RAF then?
Yes, for a few months I was in the Air Force, but in civilian uniform, and then they demobilised, you know, went for demobilisation and went into BOAC. They gave me a little book and it said retirement age approximately 35, because nobody knew what was going on, and that was the sort of life you're supposed to lead. There was a slight, can I jump back a bit in talking about this? When I went to America and I finally got on these low-level bombers, it was going to America, it was reading this American book about low-level bombers in the Army Air Corps. They made me want to do this. And there was an aircraft there called a Martin Maryland who used to do this work. But when I got to America, it didn't exist except behind a building. I found the body of one, and it was way out of date, but it was just that was my ambition to fly, because this man wrote the book called I Wanted Wings, and this inspired me to do this sort of thing.
What sort of runs were you on in BOAC before you went to the airlift?
It was the European division, so we just flew to European capitals. Like, we'd go to Vienna, and you could only do it in two hops via Frankfurt. We used to go into Berlin, we used to go up to Gothenburg, Stockholm, and down to Portugal. We used to fly in Rome, we used to fly all over, really, in these Dakotas.
And where was BOAC based?
Well, BOAC itself, it was based at Filton for a long time, but when it moved to London, the Yorks and the long-haul airplanes were flying out of what then became Heathrow, and the short-haul, which is the European division, became BA, was flying out of Northolt. So
that's where you were?
Knew Northolt quite well, really.
So can you remember the hearing about the Berlin airlift when you were
first
made aware of it?
Well, the thing was, we knew there was always trouble on the corridors going into Berlin because you had a limited height to 10,000 feet and these three limited airways we could use. And there was always problems because the Russians they wanted to grind Berlin down so it didn't exist. So they had squadrons of airplanes along the airway and they used to come up and fly around us and fly at us and all this sort of thing. Yes, they were quite anti. Until one day, a BA Viking was going into Berlin and a fighter ran into it and it crashed outside just short of Berlin. So Russians were quite anti the whole thing and very, very uncooperative, because Berlin was split, wasn't it, with the French, Americans and British sectors, but the Russian sector was a very forbidding sort of area. And they were very non-cooperative about everything you could lay your hands on, really, in the way of flight plans and all this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Were you sort of aware of this term Cold War at the time?
Much so, because when the Eisenhower stopped at the Rhine, for instance, this is before I got into Berlin, the whole feeling amongst the army, the 21st Army, we should have gone to Berlin. It said we should have crossed the river and gone into Berlin because it wasn't very far, but Eisenhower was worried about casualties, but then that would have absolved us from all these problems we had with Berlin over the years. Really was a point. And I suppose Stalin rubbed his hands over this business of Berlin. Yes, so that was the feeling, and especially when we saw the Russian equipment. A lot of the army gear when we first got into Berlin, they were using trucks which were Model T Fords with open fronts and all this sort of thing, and they didn't have very much armour. They really were, they were deficient in many ways. And the British were thinking that the Americans were backing down too much, and they were also at this stage getting a little bit feeling there, you know, they were getting on quite well, and the British Empire was something that always rather resented, I think, and this was a bit of an atmosphere at the time. Yes, so we started, we had been flying in and out of Berlin in the Air Force, and then when I got into BA, of course, it used to fly into Berlin, and we used to go out, take the aeroplane out through Copenhagen and on to Hamburg as a freighter, and then we'd convert it and take quite a few passengers, some freight, in and out of Berlin. And so we were doing this run fairly regularly. And when it got up to the airlift time, was that 48, 49-ish, something like that, things began to hot up. And there was an RAF air marshal, whose name escapes me at the moment, and he said, we've got to supply Berlin because we've got a lot of soldiers and everything there. This was the idea of it. And so he approached the Americans, who said, oh no, there's no problem. So they started an airlift of their own with Yorks and various things like this to supply Berlin. And it was only rather late on in the day the Americans caught off on that there was problems. And they then started to... But the airlift as such was really started in its early days by the RAF, thinking it's got to supply Berlin and take everything in, coal, whatever, just to keep it going. And that was the whole attitude of it, really. But it was a weird place to be, because I know when I used to stay there at night, you know, you'd hear these tanks rumbling around the place, and I know they were American tanks, but I used to carry blocks of chocolate and all that, and I thought, if there's any problems here, I'm off, and there's no aeroplane, I'm off through the countryside, anything to get away. And some which never came about. Of course, it was a Cold War thing, wasn't it? But they were always being a bit anti there.
Yes, so what was your role in the Cold War, you know, with the airlift?
Well, when it got to the airlift stage, they, of course, there were many more people that speak about this, because I was just flying in out of Berlin more or less normally, but part of this airlift. But there were then ground rules laid down, and we have, as I mentioned, written down this Babs Rebecca, which gave us very accurate distances on the way into Berlin. And also we had to leave Hamburg at precise time, under a minute, to arrive in Berlin, because they'd send in a big wave of aeroplanes and they'd all be following each other a mile or two behind, an enormous wave going in from all directions into Berlin. And I saw this once or twice in daylight, and it was quite a sight, really, to see all these aircraft landing and hurling off the end and offloading and so forth. And after the wave had stopped, there was a pause, and then they all went out and started out again.
And you were actually still based in the UK, were you?
I was still based in the UK, yes, and so forth. But the part of the Airlift Association, the British Airlift Association, a lot of those people were actually based in and around in Germany and so forth, and they were flying round the clock night and day.
So what was your sort of, as you say, you were normally going into Berlin.
Yes, yes.
When the airlift started, how did that alter your...
Only in the sense that we had to fit in with this wave going, the wave going to Berlin. I can't remember how often the waves changed over, but we had to be on an inbound wave, naturally, and an outbound wave coming out, and we had to follow the military control, of course, into Berlin.
And those corridors, you know, you had to keep those strictly.
Yes, they're not very wide, the corridors, and not very high.
How about things? You had this Rebecca, you say.
Yes, which gave distances off a beacon, so you could work out your ground speed and therefore your arrival time. And
that was important, wasn't
it? It was, yes.
Yes.
In this stream, of course, they had flying boats as well. And they were the only, I think they were the only aircraft that could carry salt. Otherwise there would have been corrosion, you know, of the aircraft body. And they used to land on the lake. But of course they could only operate in the good weather, not when there's frozen water and so forth.
And so when you were in the stream, presumably, as you say, timing was very important.
It was, yes.
Yes, and were you in the top wave?
No, the wave was always run at the same height, as far as I remember. And so when one arrived around the Berlin, and you could then see these various streams of aeroplanes and see them behind you and in front, where you haven't probably seen them before, threading into these various airfields. We used to go into RAF Gatow, which is now a Luftwaffe headquarters, and they don't fly from there anymore.
Yes. What was the sort of state of that airfield? You know, the runway.
It was again this PSP, pierced steel planking, and that was laid, and that was quite satisfactory. You get slippery, that's the only thing. You know, being steel, it's slippery. There's a crosswind and so on. But the airfield conditions were quite good, really. And the technique for the loading and unloading got better all the time. They recruited a lot of German people who were naturally interested for rations and so on to drive these trucks and all that sort of thing. There was very willing volunteers, anything to stave off the idea of the Russians going in there. This was their main wish at the whole time.
And you would have been taking people, would you?
Yes, there'd be people. I can only remember... there's only one person I can remember, but they were all people who had some priority, civilians, to go into the town. I was entertained. And strangely, the only one I can remember was this, I think, was it Alan Jones, who used to sing about the donkey. I always remember him and his wife. And I think the other one was Louis Armstrong, Satchmo. I remember him. And these were the sort of people who were given priority to go in and entertain, but there must have been many more. I can't think of them. But looking back, of course, during the comm outfits, we used to fly all sorts of people then in the Air Force, and bishops and people you think of in airplanes and that, things like that.
Would you have taken people back as well?
Oh, yes. Mm. I can't remember how many would be on board, but not very many. And they, at least they were travelling as a passenger aircraft. A lot of people that had lifts out of there, they were just sitting on the floor of the Dakotas, I think. It's rather a bare combination.
Mm. What aircraft would you have been flying?
Oh, just Dakotas. The DC-3,
yes.
Or the C-47, as the Americans call them, just the twin engine. But they were flying mostly the C-54, the Skymaster, the four-engine Douglas Skymaster they were flying, and carry a lot heavier load, of course. But everything went into Berlin. It was, whether it was tea, coffee, everything went in by air. Incredible, wasn't it?
Yes, you know, when you look back, was it impressive what they achieved?
It was very, very impressive to see what was going on. But later on, when Stalin, and it took him a long time, realised he wasn't going to win this one, that was a big deal, because then he knew then he was not going to write Berlin off. This is when he resorted to the tactics of splitting Germany and so forth. It was a very, very important point. Although it wasn't very big in Air Force history, it was a very important point from the view, for political view in Europe and the Cold War, that he could not impose his will on this sort of raggedy band of Germans left stuck in the middle of nowhere, really, sort of existing on very, very little and somehow hanging on. And this was a big mistake, because later on people always said, oh, the Berliners, you know, and they were quite heroes everywhere else, because they hung on and survived, just a matter of survival.
Yes. Do you think it made a difference to the sort of friendship of the British and
definitely.
German people?
I don't know whether there was any always terrible animosity towards the Germans. There must have bound to have been. But again, it was I think that Berlin had always been an international city, especially entertainment-wise, and I think the population hadn't got quite this Prussian militancy that other parts of the country might have had. For instance, you know, Bavarians are, in my opinion, although they look all right, I think they're a fairly aggressive lot. Whereas in the north, they're a little bit milder, I think. And we all seem to get on quite well with Berliners. I don't know why. Because we had German drivers, German ground staff, and everything like that. And this was the whole atmosphere. But the thing I do remember about Berlin, though, is the winters. The winters are fearsomely cold. The wind blows steady from the east, and it's really a very cold time in Berlin. I do remember that time of, action. And also, later on, of course, we switched to landing at Tempelhof, but that was not on the lift. We were flying into Berlin more regularly, but that was on the airlift.
I understand that's quite a difficult airfield.
It was difficult.
It
was an airfield that had... the approach to the west, you came down literally between blocks of flats, and you could see the people either side who came in. But I think that was what had been in use during the airlift, though, because that's where this chap was known who used to throw sweets out as they came in. I can't remember his name now, but we saw him at celebrations for the airlift, and that was where the kids used to gather. But it was quite an approach going through the slot there, landing, and not a very long airfield, because the other end were the marshalling yards, and I think one of the Bristol freighters ended up in the marshalling yards, but they're so high that the cockpit was above the cables, on the railway.
Were there many other civilian airlines involved in this?
Yes, there were a goodly number. There was the Lancashire Aircraft Corporation, which flew Lancasters, and then there was Laker, who had I think Halifax's. I can't remember the name of his outfit, but there were very many of them, and there was one outfit that used to fly Lancasters, and they was carrying fuel only, petrol only.